No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello, and welcome to Shallow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and that affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIOPR. And we'd be anxious to hear from you. We're going to talk about current events tonight, so please call in and be part of the conversation. Good evening, Maria. How are you?
Hey, Michael, good afternoon to you from the West Coast.
Afternoon. I keep on forgetting you people are 3 hours behind us.
Yeah, you've already lived that much longer than us.
Yes.
Good, good. And the dog days of summer, huh?
Yeah, but not as bad. You know, our hearts go out to the people of California. How is the whole wildfire thing? How is that going?
It's terrible. And they say it is the future is now with climate change and the West getting hotter than ever, and that this is our new norm and this is what we should come to expect. And people are interestingly getting their homes canceled with their fire insurance because it's deemed brush, even though they've had a policy for, say, 20 years without any losses, because insurance companies are getting out of the business because it's too hazardous.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is,
and maybe you'll have to have government insurance. You know, you couldn't have a beach house in America if there wasn't a government insurance policy program, because nobody would, no private insurance companies would insure houses on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. You know, there are just too many.
Because too flooding? Too much flooding?
Yeah, and too many hurricanes.
Oh, you're kidding.
Know, they have hurricanes all the time. No. Really, Cape Hatteras, you know, it was known as the, you know, naval graveyard back in the 19th century because so many ships sunk in storms off the coast. So they have a ton of hurricanes. And I think that's true in South Carolina and most of Georgia as well. I don't know how it is in California. It always shocked me when I went out there to see where Californians are willing to build houses, like hanging off of cliffs and stuff.
Yeah, but, yeah, and on stilts.
Yeah, and they do that. Violence. They do that in North Carolina too, to you know, to help with some of the flooding. A lot of houses don't start
The ground.
Like 12 feet off the ground, and they use the underneath part for parking.
Flooding.
And flooding. So maybe that'll happen in North Carolina. In California.
I just met up with a girlfriend on Friday, and they have a family home that's on the beach in the Orange County area that their like grandfather owned. So it's 80 years in the family. And because the California Coastal Commission is one of those kind of eminent domain seas when they can, you can't say this about our sand and stuff, which I kind of understand to some point, like a homeowner can't own the ocean. Mm-hmm. Right. But you know, so she said that there used to be a whole bunch of beachfront and now there's like maybe a foot where the water stops before the house because
of the
rising of the oceans.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, I don't want to digress here, but the Hawaiians have the greatest law. You know, there are no private beaches in Hawaii. So if you're in Hawaii and you decide you want to go hang out at the Waikoloa Hilton on the beach. You can just go there. You don't have to be staying at the Hilton. You don't have to, because nobody's allowed to have a private beach. In the
States. California only has two, apparently.
Oh, is
and
that
the rest,
right?
Yeah, the rest is to the peoples. But there has to be egress, of course, to get there. And they allow for that. Again, I said I understand. Howsoever, regardless of legislation and laws and accessibility and access, the ocean is rising. So it's gobbling up the coastline or the shore, if you will.
Well, and just to, you know, to tell you that we're greedy out here on the East Coast because all the beaches out here are private. I think, well, that's not true. A lot of them are public, but there are also many private beaches on the East Coast.
We really?
Have a different. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, you know, I understand East Coast law is UK driven, I think, and West Coast law is Spain driven. And there is a difference in the interpretation thereof.
I've always thought it's because you people eat too much yogurt and trail mix.
Well, wait a second.
I got to be honest.
Just remind everybody how many Californians versus other states have signed on to the DC for statehood.
Well, it's so funny that you should bring that up because because you have you've just made a fabulous transition. We got a new co-signer this week
from California.
No, from Illinois, Senator Tammy Duckworth. So that brings us up to 28 in the Senate and 166 in the House for a grand total of 195. But of that 195, 32 of them are from California.
There you have
it. More than anybody else.
And what's the second next?
Both in New York, but I haven't counted them up from New York.
Okay.
But they're way behind. You know, you're at least half a dozen ahead of New York. And we have both your senators, too. Both senators, both California senators, Feinstein and Harris, are on. And also 30 members of the House. So something those people in California know that the rest of you ought to get hip to, and that is that the District of Columbia needs to be a state. Thank you, Californians. We hope that, you know, you can all continue to live there. But if,
well,
if
and maybe you're
driven
should...
out by fire and ocean, come to D.C.
Yeah.
We'll
and earthquakes.
Care.
But maybe you should promote yogurt consumption.
Yogurt, I can't.
If you think that's what's making...
I'm originally from New Jersey. I've got to tell you a great story. When I was a kid, my father had this friend named George Macris, and he was like a regional manager for Coca-Cola in our hometown of Newark, New Jersey. So he had like Newark, and he had New York City, and pretty big deal. And he comes to my father. Now, this is almost 50 years ago. And he says, I've just been promoted to be the head of a new division at Coca-Cola called Gannon Yogurt.
Oh, you're kidding.
And my father, I'll never forget this. My father said to him, are you crazy? He said, have you ever tasted that stuff? and he said, yeah. And he goes, my father said, look, during the war, you know, I was in Sweden and I had some. He goes, you're making Coca-Cola. And I remember him kept on saying to him, Coca-Cola. It's Coca-Cola. Everybody loves Coca-Cola. The yogurt thing. He goes, look, this Danon thing, this is never going to last. Which might be one of the reasons that the Brown family has always been such great investors, you know, because
exactly.
We have those kind of insights into things.
You can foresee
the future. I remember that. That was Mr. Macris and Danon, and I think he did pretty well for himself, was my recollection. But it was our favorite place to go as kids because they had wooden cases of Coca-Cola stacked up in their pantry. They had like 1,000 bottles of Coca-Cola. You'd have as much Coca-Cola as you could drink in a
really?
Day.
They would have that on hand.
Yeah.
In the glass bottles.
Frito-Lay. They also own Frito-Lay. So Fritos and potato chips. And, you know, that was before we knew all that stuff was bad for you.
I was going to say, I'm not hearing any nutritive value here.
No. And I used to sit at the table as a kid, and I'd pour a Coke, and I'd take a teaspoon of sugar, and I'd put it in the Coke.
You're kidding.
No. You know,
is that a Southern thing, Eastern thing?
No, I think in my case it was a pre-diabetic
thing. Oh, I think, still, right.
I mean, look, you know, good and plenty is crack to me. If you put 50 pounds of good and plenty in front of me, I'd probably eat it till I died, or they took me to the hospital. You know, there's just something. I've had a lifelong love affair with sugar, unfortunately, and much to my amazement, they have taken sugar-free stuff, which I've been eating for 15 or 20 years, and they've taken it from being really nasty, terrible tasting stuff into pretty good stuff. So a lot of stuff you can't tell the difference between sugar and so if you haven't tried like sugar-free ice cream in a while and sugar-free, you have to pick the right brands, but you know, Russell Stover's makes a whole line of sugar-free candies, which is fabulous, and Breyers makes great sugar-free ice cream bars. And
what do they sweeten it with?
Different things now. They have Splenda, of course, which is one of the more widely used
plant-based, right?
Yeah, and stevia is the new. And I got to tell you, I've tried stevia and I thought it was horrible, but I just got some Russell Stover's candy and they've switched all their candy over to it, from Splenda, and the candy's great. So I guess it's just how you use it. But, yeah, I tried it in my coffee and I was like, oh no, I'm back to Splenda. So,
cause there's the, tequila plant nectar, agave, that they say is a good sweetener and low glycemic index.
Yeah,
it's like honey, but it comes from a plant.
Yeah, so and tequila has very few carbohydrates in it as well. So if you don't like the agave, you can always do a couple of shooters.
And there was a study this week published on Friday that says low carbohydrate eaters die 4 years sooner.
I know.
Than
the
rest of us. And a high carbohydrate consumer dies 1 year earlier than the moderate carbohydrate eaters. And I brought that up. I had my three sons and their three women over for brunch today. And they go on these various iterations of the keto diet, which is basically
I was on Atkins for a while.
Yeah, and they say Atkins and keto are different because of this, that, and the other. I said the point is carbohydrates. And in both of those programs, you don't eat carbohydrates. It's high protein and high fat.
Right. And well, and the thing that was attractive to me about the one diet was that Atkins was that it was easy. You didn't have to think about it. You know, you can eat anything you want. Just make sure it doesn't have any carbohydrates in it.
Well, so, but no fruit, you know, and vegetables in general,
fruit,
right?
No fruit, vegetables. That was hard. Yeah. But, you know, but my brother-in-law used to call it the bacon diet.
Yes, exactly.
You eat 2 pounds of bacon for breakfast.
Yeah, and it was okay.
Yeah, well, according to Dr. Atkins, it was okay. But I'm not sure your cardiologist would agree.
Agreed.
So let's talk. We really can't
we're
going to
talk about the deaths first.
Into the show without saying something about Aretha Franklin.
Yeah.
Did
she strike a nerve with people this week, huh? I mean, I was just actually amazed and surprised at the amount of reactions of her loss from walks of life.
We're going to play a song that she did at the end of the show today in her honor. But I got to tell you, when I went on the internet to look at picking a song, now I've got a dozen that are favorites of mine. But when I saw the
her catalog
body of work that she had done in all sorts of genres, and that might be it, you know. She was tagged the Queen of Soul, but she also did gospel music. She's also done some, you know, what I would call standards. You know, we're going to play.
Well, they said she was a mezzo soprano too, with a multi-octave range.
Yeah, like five octaves, some ridiculous amount. And I've got to tell you, I'm going to tell you my Aretha Franklin story. I was at the convention in 1991, the Democratic convention. And they gave me the job of allowing people up on the podium, giving out temporary podium passes. So now everybody wants to be up on the podium. You know, that's the hot place to be in. If you ever noticed at the conventions, the podiums are gigantic. The stage area, you know, there's 100 people that sit up there, and they bring choirs and all sorts of people up there. So the deal was that they stationed me at one side of the podium and another person on the other side. And if you wanted to get up on the podium and you didn't have a credential, you had to come plead your case to me. And if you convinced me that you needed to be up there, then I would issue a temporary podium pass, which was good.
You a punk kid?
Yeah, and that
you were
was,
a punk.
Oh.
91.
I would tell you the rest of the story after I tell you about Aretha, but
okay.
But yeah, you had to come to me. And the Secret Service, if I gave you the pass, the Secret Service was fine with it and they let you up there.
That's
and
a
they
lot
were
of
really
power.
In charge of security. But you know, and they did it, I think, because they made me one of those people because I had been a consultant at the DNC for, you know, even in those days, I'd been on staff for 5 years and I'd been a consultant for another, by 91, another 6 or 7 years. So I knew a lot of the players. And that's what they always worry about, right? They don't want some guy that gave the party $25,000 to go up to get on the podium and have the guy say, I don't know who you are, or, you know, or I don't care who you are. So they wanted to make sure they knew they had somebody who knew who the right people to kiss up to was. So that was me. And one day, just before the convention started that evening, let's say it's maybe activity started at 6, and I had to be there at 4. I was there and, this guy comes up to me and he says, hi, I'm Aretha Franklin's son, and she's singing the national anthem tonight, and we need to get up on stage, me and these two technicians, we need to get up on stage in the podium because we're doing a sound check. This is her manager, and this guy's her sound guy or something. So I said, of course. I gave him the passes. They went up. They did whatever they did. And they came down and gave me the passes back. They were very nice. And that night, after she sang the national anthem, she was walking off stage. And as she came by me, her son was in front of her. He stopped the entourage, the whole entourage. There were like 8 of them. And he said to his mother, this is the guy that helped us this afternoon.
Aww.
Reached over and grabbed my arm, my forearm, and went, thank you. And just then, Mrs. Brown, who was my fiance at the time, came around the corner. A couple of my friends had gotten her backstage pass just in time to see me flip out and go, oh my God, Aretha touched me. She touched me. She touched me right there. I'm never going to wash again. That's where she touched me. There she is.
You knew then you were that in awe of her then?
What?
You were that in awe of her then?
Of Aretha Franklin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa. You know,
her biggest hits were when I was in high school, long before that. Respect, Think, you know, all are great. All are Heard It Through. All are great. All are, no, that was Gladys Knight, wasn't it? All of her great hits, though, were back. When I was in high school, she was like the big thing. When I went to high school, the two types of music that were coming up were popular were groups like the Beatles and the Who and the Rolling Stones. But what had always been popular was Motown. That was my brother's music. My older brother, you know, the Four Tops, the Four Seasons, the Temptations. And that's what I grew up on in middle school and high school.
As a white boy.
Class school. Yeah, but we were greasers. We were, you know, we wore leather jackets and we had long hair, but it was greased back. And we were working class. We weren't hippies yet. We didn't get to be hippies till we were in college. But yeah, Aretha Franklin, oh my God, she's, I probably know every lyric to every song.
That's, wow.
Yeah, I'm a big pop music fan, first of all.
I love how eclectic and vast your love of and knowledge of music is, just like of history. But I had no idea about Aretha. There you go.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and I like so much different kind of music because I like pop music. And so so I not only like Aretha Franklin, I like Ariana Grande, you know, and I like Taylor Swift, and I like Katy Perry, and I like, you know what I mean? I like, it's, you know, I have friends, my kids criticize me for being stuck in the 1960s because I like the Beach. I also like the Beach Boys and Aretha Franklin, you know, but yeah, I try to, I like pop music. And yes, yeah, she was the queen. She was the queen. And, you know, I think a funny thing about her and some of the other people I followed over the years is that these women that learned how to sing in church, they not only do it better somehow, more soulfully, but they also, you know, she was in her 70s, and I heard her sing last year, and she was great. You know, they also keep the, I don't know what it is about that training, but, you know, when you look at people like her and Gladys Knight and Whitney Houston and, you know, people that were brought up singing in the church, they just seem to go in, you know.
Well, that speaks to the black culture, too, don't you think? Because how many female church singers do we know of that are white?
Well, you know, I went to an Episcopal church, and you know, I remember getting in fights over Amazing Grace because it was too new wave. You know, that was one of our, you know, that was the thing about Episcopal music. I said one time in front of a crowd of African Americans and made them laugh at a Baptist Baptist get together where I just heard this amazing choir sing. I said, well, I was in an Episcopal church and we don't sing like we want to make a joyous noise. We take the Bible literally. And when it said God rested on the seventh day on Sunday, we all sing real quiet and gently, like we don't want to wake them up. You know? And they all laughed, and I said, because it's true, we're really very, you know, there are a lot of hymns and stuff, but these people, and in fact, at one time, I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but at one time, I had a friend who would send me every year the 10 worst country music lyrics.
Dear, that sounds terrible.
They were published by a radio station in St. Louis. I think there were some great ones, like, you know, my wife dumped me and took my truck and a dog, and mm-hmm. I missed the dog, and mm-hmm. and, you know, but my favorite was, I've got tears in my ears.
Yes, from lying on my back crying over you. Yes, I remember.
So I wrote a song, and I wrote a song, the lyrics to a song. And I sent it to my friend, and he tried to put it to music, but we never really quite got it together. And it was called Jesus Jumped Up and Grabbed Me by the Soul. And it was a gospel. I love gospel music. So, but I love that kind of tambourine thumping. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I don't like new wave Christian music. Not that I have anything against it. It just doesn't do anything for me. But I love hymns like God is trying to tell you something. There's a, like, the classic gospel hymn for me. It's from the movie The Color Purple. But yeah, I love that stuff. And Aretha was so good at it and was so miss her. And a lot of people don't know this, but she was a good Democrat. She came to a lot of things. I saw her perform many times. Of course, she performed at Obama's inauguration. And she was a social activist. She was very involved in the civil rights movement. She really kept a low profile about it, but she loaned her talent quite often to good causes and civil rights causes. And she used her, you know, she contributed generously to many different charities that worked for the betterment of African Americans and for equal rights. So,
well, the other thing, Michael, is that she had challenges that I hadn't. I heard that her mother left when she was six, and she claimed that it was an abandonment. But her mother died when she was 10, and Aretha had her first child when she was 12.
Yes.
And had her second one by the time she was 15.
Yeah, I had no idea she was that young, but yes, I know that she was very young.
Yeah, and then went to New York when she was 18, and her children went somewhere else, so there must have been extended family involved in their upbringing. I mean, that's a lot for a young person who's not yet an adult to endure.
Well, you know, her father was a
controversial
radio minister, though.
But he had his own church in Detroit, which is why they relocated there.
And he was on the radio, and he was one of the biggest radio, you know, guys evidently throughout the South, you know, like the Jim and Tammy Baker kind of, well, maybe I shouldn't compare them, but you know, black minister on the radio. And actually, he brought Aretha when she was very young to a studio in Muscle Shoals. And Muscle Shoals, there was a group of record producers in Muscle Shoals who perfected a thing called the Muscle Shoals sound, and it was very big in the 60s. So one of their biggest artists was Otis Redding. And they brought Aretha came in one night with her father and to audition to make a tape for the radio station. And the station manager said to the technician, look, record this kid, you know, wrap the tape up, file it somewhere. We can't afford to piss her dad off because her dad is on all these radio stations in the South. And, you know, we want to make nice with him, right? We want our records played. So they had her do a Respect, which was an Otis Redding song, which had already been released by Otis Redding, actually. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't remember it because it was such a bigger hit for her.
By her,
but they
right.
They did it, and they shelved it, and nobody listened to it. And, like, months and months went by, and somebody was cleaning out a bunch of stuff and, you know, just didn't know what it was and listened to it and went, holy moly. And when they decided that they were going to put it out, they couldn't even find her to get her to record a side B. There was no side B of the record because that's all she had done. And they couldn't even find her because nobody bothered to take her name and address.
You're kidding.
No.
That's a story.
Yeah, I heard it on.
They call it towering.
Yeah, I hope that was accurate. I heard it on Behind the Music.
I hope it's accurate too, Michael.
Yeah, I heard it on. I remember it because I was because I'm such a fan. I was watching a MTV series called Behind the Music, and that's what they said. They had the producer on and everything. They you know, it took them a while to find her, and they had to. And I forget what side B was, but it was also big hit. Can't remember. But listen to all these songs she did. You Make Me Feel Like an Actual Woman, I Say a Little Prayer, Respect, Chain of Fools, Think, Never Loved a Man, Ain't No Way, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Change Gonna Come, Until You Come Back to Me. Those are just some of her hits, you know, records that made the top 40. Even songs like Bridge Over Trouble, you know, that's what I say. You know, that was a Simon Garfunkel song, but she also did gospel, and she was all over, and she used her talent for good. So,
And only 76. And I say only because that seems like even my dad passed away at 88. I mean, his mother passed away at 102. 76 sounds really young to me.
Well, 76 used to sound so old that I couldn't believe anybody lived that long. But now that I'm 65, it sounds a lot Yeah, it doesn't sound that old to me either. You know. But anyway, so we wish her, we hope
to rest in peace.
And rest in peace. And to her friends and family, people that really knew her, our deepest condolences, because she was a great person. And, you know, that was my 15-second brush of fame.
Oh, right.
With her. I never even said anything to her. She just said, thank you. I might have said, you're welcome. I can't remember.
I'm sure you did. You always raised the gentleman.
I was just stunned to meet her. And it's very funny. You know, that same, very same day, I'm like an hour earlier, I met Rosa Parks. And I was standing at
the... No one gets to say that.
I was standing at the bottom of the podium, and she was standing there. People had brought her
over. How did you know that it was her?
I didn't. People had brought her over, and she was standing there. She's a very unassuming person. But she had been brought over by a couple of handlers, and they had walked away and left her at the bottom of the podium for a few minutes or something. And there were other people working around, and I saw some of them talking. And I said, you know, she looked like somebody. I didn't know who she was. I recognized her as being somebody that I should know. And I asked somebody, who is that? And they said, Rosa Parks. And I said, Rosa Parks? You mean the Montgomery bus boycott Rosa Parks?
And they went, the one, the only?
Yeah, that's her. And I went over and I introduced myself to her. And I said something like, Miss Parks, it's such a great honor to meet you. You know, I studied about you in college and you were so brave. And I just wanted to come over and say hello and tell you what an honor it is to meet you. And she said something like, thank you. You know, wasn't effusive or anything. She was a little tiny lady. I'll never forget her. Little tiny lady in kind of an eggplant colored dress with
something
your grandmother would wear, with big glasses and hair that was braided but twisted and piled on top of her head. You know what I mean? But in braids and so it was a banner. It was a banner day.
That's quite the recollection, Michael, and the description as well.
Well, you know, I mean,
I don't often hear men describe someone's wardrobe in the shade of eggplant.
Well, you know what? I grew up in selling men's clothes, so I was...
That's right. That's right.
I was trained. I can even, till this day, I can do cuffs on pants and shortened sleeves on jackets and, you know, stuff like that that I was trained to do. It was an interesting upbringing. And
no wonder you have so much cachet and panache.
Oh, panache. Yeah. My kids have another word for it. But, you know, let's turn to what's going on this week.
Well, wait, but Kofi Annan.
I have to tell you, he attacked us in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I saw. You might as well share.
Yeah, and now the mayor, I mean, the mayor's going to make a lot of hay out of this, right? She's gonna become a national figure over this. But as you probably heard, Donald Trump, President Trump, wanted to have a military parade, and he wanted to, I guess he was so impressed when he was in Paris and saw the parade that the French had on Bastille Day, that he wanted to do a similar parade. So it came out this week that the parade was going to cost $92 million.
Yeah.
Which was $80 million more than the estimate. And so he blamed that on D.C. He was said he was being gouged by the people of D.C., the people that run the District of Columbia. Mm-hmm. Actually, the mayor...
And their piss-poor management.
Well, you know what? We've got one of the worst school systems in the country and a bunch of other problems. So the piss poor management thing, I guess we could argue about. We think Congress
Boy, that's big of you.
Responsive. responsible for
that. Well,
there's
that. You do have, daddy.
You have plenty of problems. Luckily, we also, for a jurisdiction that's less than 10 miles square, have $14.5 billion budget. So they're wasting money, but they got a lot to waste. But anyway, the mayor shook back, and the mayor actually put in a figure of $21,600,000. The rest of it was put together by the Pentagon and other people.
You mean they added on to it?
Yeah, they added on to it. Well, our estimate was $21,600,000, but that's for the District of Columbia's participation. It's not, you know, so there are a lot of other elements, right?
Like public safety and stuff.
That's what it is. Yeah. So
well, that includes public safety.
Yeah. So what happens is that there's a lot of other costs. You know, you can't fly a half a dozen F-16s over the nation's capital without it costing a couple of bucks, you know. Uh-huh. So there's all that and the military personnel and the people that you have to bring in. And I'm sure there's federal security in addition to local security. So all those totaled $92 million, and the president blamed it on the district trying to gouge him. Now, the White House today said Mick Mulvaney, who's the budget director, said today that he thinks it's more than just money. He said he thinks there were other reasons that the parade was canceled. But he said it should be no surprise, and I thought this was kind of a funny remark, it should be no surprise that a jurisdiction that voted 70% to 80% for Hillary Clinton should not be anxious to have a parade for the president. The truth of the matter is the District of Columbia voted 94%.
Rub it in, Michael.
You know, so yeah, so it's a little like, you know, you're going to throw a party, but you've decided to throw it at your ex-wife's house. You know, it's not gonna right. It's not gonna go quite as well as you might have planned it. There's gonna be a little. So that's what's going on here. So we're in a fight with the president. Uncharacteristic. Our mayor really doesn't say much about him. You know, she focuses on local stuff and leaves the, you know, as a rule, she doesn't say much about him, but she tweeted out, yeah, it was 21-6. That's what it cost based on his inauguration, which was the only thing they really had, the only model, I guess, they had.
Oh, that's true. With,
you know.
Yeah, commensurate, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And especially today, you know, I mean, it's so much different than it was, Maria. You know, we used to go to the mall all the time for things. The last inauguration, they had fences. They put up fences all on the mall, chain link fences around. And you had to go in through particular entry points. So if you got out of a metro station, you might have to walk 10 blocks to an entry point because the one that's right where you got out is closed. It's fenced off. And, you know, it seemed to me that during, and this has happened for several events now. When I went to the 50th anniversary march, I was part of the 50th anniversary march for the March on Washington, Martin Luther King's March on Washington. And they did the same thing with fences. And we even had to fight. We had we have a little monument on the mall. It's our World War One monument. And we threw we had speeches and activities. We threw an event there, and we had to fight with the Secret Service to be able to drop people in their 70s and 80s that were coming to the Martin Luther King Memorial, which was right across the mall, to get them to drop off there. They were going to make us drop them off 7 blocks away.
We're like, so crazy. The fencing isn't something new. Because when you say we walked on the mall, a lot of people don't know what you mean.
Yeah,
because
not true.
Our vernacular.
No,
pedestrians as a shopping mall.
Yeah,
mall, you mean the Washington.
Right. No, the mall, the area between the Lincoln Memorial and the Capitol, which is an open area. And it's also, these are new since 9/11, not new like.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But progressively getting more restrictive and more restrictive. So 9/11, you know, the mall was still pretty much an open area. But by the time Barack Obama got inaugurated, that was the first time that I had ever seen the fences go up, was his first inauguration.
Oh.
So afraid security of the African-American president. Oh, right. And nobody knew what was going to happen. And that leads me to something else I'd like to at least mention, and that's that, you know, the District of Columbia, the week before last, spent $2.6 million to protect the 20 Nazi white supremacists.
I read that too.
$2.6 million.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I think it's important to protect people's right to free speech. And I'm sure that very few of our listeners had anything in common with those people that spoke. And I certainly don't believe in any of the kind of hate speech they put out there. But I think it's important to preserve their right to free speech. It's everybody's right. But $2.6 million, where do we draw the line? For 20 people, ended up being 20 people. I mean, the counter protesters were probably thousands, you know, all around the city. But actually at Lafayette Square, they said a couple hundred. So there were hundreds of anti-protesters, but only 20 of the people that got the original permit. I don't know. What do we do? You know, that's a tough problem. $2.6 million. Federal government, I think, I don't know if they'll reimburse us for all of it, but I think they reimburse us for some of it.
It's so when you talk about where do we draw the line, that's a topic that I've become exceedingly and obsessively concerned with, because we're really talking about ethics here, because we're not talking about legal or moral. We're talking about situational. Is that the best use of our public dollar, public service, those 20 lives that were ostensibly protected, et cetera. And ethics is subject to the eye of the beholder.
Well, yeah, it's a really, really tough call.
It's a really tough call, Michael. That's the point, is that it's not black and white.
Yeah. And we have these things all the time, right? There are lots of things that we spend inordinate amounts of money on. I'm a pleasure boater. If I go out, if I'm dumb enough to take a sailboat and go out in the middle of a storm somewhere, the Coast Guard, God knows what the Coast Guard spends to send somebody to rescue me when I'm.
Yeah, but doesn't that ultimately get billed back to you?
No. Billed back to me,
Because search and rescue in my county, when people get lost, like in the forest, and the law enforcement is engaged in getting them to safety, my understanding, just like an ambulance, you're billed for that.
Well, how are you going to bill an eight-year-old kid that wanders off into Yosemite Park, and they send 20 people out to find him?
He has
they can find him
parents.
Before it's dark. You know,
parents.
Or look at a movie like The Perfect Storm. You send two helicopter crews and a ship out to save a pleasure boater. How can you? Probably millions of dollars. Probably cost millions of dollars.
I think that's recoverable. I think they subrogate.
I don't think so. I don't know about that, but. You could take it further. You could say we subsidize all sorts of things.
Here's an ethical question that's coming up in California with the wildfires. One of the fires that happened in Northern California, and I don't recall which one, a decision was made to galvanize the limited personnel of the firefighting community around the more expensive homes.
Yeah.
And the less expensive socioeconomic households were inordinately affected because of that. Okay, so there's only so many resources. There's so many hands, right? There's only so much water. So somebody made the decision. So now they're going into the ethics of that. Who made that decision and why? And then you could say that, well, multi-million dollar homes are ultimately going to cost more and take longer time to replace. Therefore, economically, it makes sense to let the smaller, less expensive homes burn. But then you can say, well, that is probably has to do with caste, right? Or status. Or
yeah.
Okay. So somebody made that decision and somebody has to justify that decision. So what's the right decision?
Well, first of all, let me make this statement to America. I've had money and I've been broke, and it's better to be rich than it is to be poor. Don't make any mistake about it. Having money is a good thing on a personal level. So I think those people are going to have more influence. But, yeah, I don't know how you make those.
Well,
because
you
know
could
how
also
you
argue
make those decisions.
The people who have more money are probably better well insured.
Probably are.
I mean, we're making some gross generalizations here. I understand some real broad brush strokes. But there probably would be rebuilt at replacement costs, whereas maybe smaller socioeconomic societies, maybe not so much. Maybe they don't have replacement cost coverage. Maybe they just have what they contracted to, which would be at the time of the purchase price, which wouldn't accommodate for inflation or all of those things that go into real estate. So I wouldn't have wanted to be the person who made that decision, and I wouldn't want to be that person now, because somebody's going to have to answer to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing that I remember distinctly from my college education is my first year textbook definition of economics, which is economics is the study of the allocation of scarce resources among alternative uses. So this is a constant problem in government. There, you know, economics assumes that there's scarcity and that you have to make choices. And these are choices that are made every day in society that are very, very tough sometimes. And that's where politics, you know, gets into it, right? Right now we have lots of problems in D.C. We have a $14.5 billion budget, but we still have an unbelievable housing shortage, and there's very little affordable housing. We have a large homelessness problem. Our education system isn't very good. We have to decide every day. People have to decide in city government every day to use this money for this, which means not being able to use it for that. Mm. So it's the constant dilemma.
But I saw firsthand when I was there in April, all of your housing starts. In fact, my friend pointed out about all the cranes. You've got a nickname now, like District of the Cranes or something.
Yeah,
or that's your state
so
bird now,
is
the crane.
We've got so much damn money. The state bird of the District of Columbia is the wood thrush, and I have no idea why, but I'd like to. I think we need a more stately animal, for Christ's sakes. It's probably the state bird of California is probably like the bald eagle or something, and we've got the wood thrush, you know.
They were joking that your state bird is the crane because much construction going on.
Much construction, but it's not meant for
affordable housing.
Yeah, you know, and one of my hobbies in life is spending the money, the make-believe money that I'm going to get when I win the Powerball lottery.
Oh, do you buy tickets?
I buy a ticket every week. Yes.
Do you? And I've never bought a ticket. I have a girlfriend.
And I think I ought to get some prize because there are six numbers and I never get any of them. I would put my record of not getting one single number, you know, as I.
Hey, what are the odds of that? That should be
exactly,
a surprise.
Exactly. You know, I often say the only thing I ever won was the draft lottery, but, the, you know, it's nothing to pay at, in Woodley Park, for example, a neighborhood in Washington, in a beautiful, beautiful building. But it's nothing to pay $4 million for a three-bedroom apartment.
You're kidding.
No.
Oh.
We have...
Oh, dear.
We have apartments that are not in good sections of the city that rent for $3,500 a month for two bedrooms. You know, I mean, that's the problem. I had a friend, a dear friend, who worked for a nonprofit, and what they did was rehab houses, and they got some government money to do this, and then they sold the houses. But the houses were sold at 20% below market value to people that qualified. And he said they would rehab the houses, and housing prices were going up so fast that even 20% below market value, people that lived in the neighborhoods couldn't afford to buy them because, you know, they'd rehab a place that was, you know, maybe sold for $100,000 because it was condemned, and they rehab it and it go on the market for $325,000.
Oh my goodness.
You can't buy. Our house was just appraised because we took equity out of it to do some repairs, but it was appraised at more than three times what we paid for it.
But you've owned it for decades, right?
Yeah, we've owned it for a while. But none of my kids live here, except the ones that live with me.
Yeah.
You know, they can't afford it.
And that's the neighborhood that I, or the county that I live in, because our children, we keep getting older, our children grow, and then they leave because they can't afford. So the city, actually, that I live in is got this master plan that includes mixed-use development. So they're going to make the streets narrower. They're going to make the parking around at the back. They're going to make it downstairs business and cafes and bistros, and then upstairs housing, like it used to be in New York, say.
In D.C. they've done that, yeah.
And my peers have been against it. And it's like, hello, do we want to become a senior city? Or do we want to have some... Right. You know, the next generation and youth and people pushing strollers and stuff. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. I think that everyone thinks it's going to affect their property values. And I just think,
well,
it's,
you know,
add to the property taxes. It's going to add to the sales tax. It's going to add to the gasoline tax. Density brings value too.
Well, and you know, there's always people that are against change, which is crazy. Because the only constant in the universe is change.
And if you don't embrace it.
Everywhere in every instance is change. But yeah, people worry about that. And
then there's the not in my backyards.
The NIMBY people.
Yeah, and I'm like, yes, please.
Okay, well, we got to wrap up now. So I'm going to ask you the question I wanted to ask you since we started today. Omarosa, is she crazy? Or you think she's being honest?
You know, I actually interviewed her years ago during The Apprentice, yeah. And she was really forthright and straightforward then. So I would imagine she's probably that person today.
You know, I met her briefly in Cleveland because we were invited by the Republicans to come to the convention in Cleveland, the local Republicans.
Good Republicans.
Yeah, and she came and she talked to everybody. Only met her for a minute, but she seemed the same way to me.
And what do you think?
I don't know. I don't know. I think that, yeah, I think that she's probably telling a lot of the truth, I think.
Yeah.
So
we end with Aretha.
We'll see you next week. Look, we end with Aretha, but listen, folks, tune in next week because Maria and I have been all over the place lately. But next week, we're going to do a whole show on statehood, and we're going to have some interesting statehood guests. So please tune in to listen to us. And Maria, you say goodnight.
And we thank you for taking the time to make us a part of your week, and we hope you have a great one.
Give the people their right to vote.